Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 397. In the news, just wanted to give a huge shout out to Brother Anthony Washi and the brothers of Gate City Lodge number 2 and our companions of Mount Zion chapter number 16, both in Atlanta, Georgia, for the hospitality and the wonderful time out there. You are listening to this, and I'm likely flying home from Cleveland, Ohio. I think I kept saying Columbus. That's probably because that's where the headquarters of my employer resides. Anyway, Cleveland, Ohio is where I was, and presenting out at Lakeshore Lodge number 307 in Madison, Ohio. And I'm recording this before flying out to Ohio, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say, I'm guessing I had a wonderful time, and I'll fill you all in on those details just as soon as I can. I'll be spending the time with our brother Mike Hambricht from the Masonic Roundtable and our good friend Brother Chris Maddie, and it's going to be a good time. We're going to check out some outdoor degree work and do a presentation. It's going to be a lot of fun, or rather, it has been fun. This week I have 2 papers, and of course, illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison. I forgot to include the Masonic Minute last week, so we're going to put that new Masonic Minute, number 101, you guys, in this episode. It's going to be fantastic. I know you will enjoy it, and this episode, I've actually got a paper by Steve Harrison that was published on the Midnight Freemasons, but also I wanted to dive into something I found a little mysterious, and that is Solomon's Shamir. What is that? Well, I'll tell you guys all about it. If you don't know, imagine a mythical device that cut stone at the building of King Solomon's temple. Was it a device, or was it these little worm creatures that he controlled that had to be kept inside of a lead box? I don't know. But we're going to find out more right after this. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose, really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Banker's Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Banker's Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Banker's Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with On It. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out.
All right, let's start this Stephen L. Harrison party off the right way with a reading of his latest piece called Bucking the Trend by Midnight Freemason contributor Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd degree, FMLR. What is FMLR? Well, that's a fellow of the Missouri Lodge of Research. Let's take this one. The Missouri Lodge of Research evolved from a research council formed in 1927 by a group of Masons, which included famed Masonic author Ray Denslow and an obscure county judge named Harry Truman. The idea to turn the Missouri Masonic Research Council into an actual lodge came along in 1938 and was summarily voted down at Grand Lodge because, well, we've never done that before. 2 years later, with that obscure judge Truman, now a U.S. Senator serving as the Grand Master, the proposal went through and the Missouri Lodge of Research was born. It bears the distinction of being the only Masonic Lodge, research or otherwise, to having the sitting President of the United States as its master. The Lodge flourished over the years, providing members an outlet to meet and discuss topics of interest as well as publishing Masonic papers, articles, and books. Early on, it became a mainstay of the Missouri Lodge of Research to provide its members with a book each year, usually one that the Lodge published itself. Many of the books were the products of the Denslows, Ray and his son William, who wrote the epic 10,000 Famous Freemasons. Those books attracted members not just from Missouri, but from all over the country and even outside the U.S. In time, the Missouri Lodge of Research became the largest U.S. research lodge and was probably second in prestige only to England's famous Vittori Coronati. As Masonic membership began to decline after the post-war boom years, the Missouri Lodge of Research's membership also started to decline, but it held its own in comparison to other Masonic institutions, thanks mostly to the quality of the books it was distributing. Then, in 2001, it began distributing a series of books, Lodges of Missouri. This consisted of 5 volumes which detailed the history of each Masonic lodge in the jurisdiction. The Lodge distributed one of the 5 volumes as its annual book for 5 consecutive years. The Lodges of Missouri series was a valuable addition to the history of Missouri Freemasonry. It was probably unique to the Grand Lodge of Missouri for a Grand Lodge to have such a detailed history of each of its individual lodges. Unfortunately, issuing this series proved to be a major tactical error. Members outside Missouri had little interest in the series. Even within the jurisdiction, members tired of seeing the books come year after year, especially for the volumes that didn't contain their own lodges. Membership plummeted. Over that period, the Missouri Lodge of Research lost about half its membership. Not only was it not holding its own, it was actually losing membership at a faster rate than Masonry in general. Facing this crisis, the Missouri Lodge of Research officers met to come up with a plan to reverse the trend. Immediately, of course, it began releasing books of a more general and popular Masonic interest. In addition to that, the officers took the following measures. Established the Truman Lecture Series, bringing in world-class Masonic speakers twice a year to speak at its semi-annual meetings. This series has featured such speakers as Clifton Truman Daniel, Joseph Wages, Alton Rountree, Arturo de Hoyos, Trevor Stewart, Robert Cooper, Brent Morris, Chris Hodapp, and more. It took responsibility for the management of the Missouri Masonic Museum in Columbia. The museum details the Masonic history of Missouri and elsewhere, and contains unique memorabilia such as Harry Truman's cane and glasses, the Masonic apron of Meriwether Lewis and Wild Bill Hillcock's alleged lodge chair. It built a comprehensive Masonic library at its Masonic complex. The library now contains many priceless artifacts as well as thousands of books, many rare or one-of-a-kind. It also provides an online electronic catalog and is working to digitize many of its volumes. It enhanced its newsletter, which now contains articles of esoteric and historical Masonic interest, as well as being a vehicle to communicate regularly with its membership. It sponsors a Lodge of Research breakfast on the final day of Grand Lodge sessions, at which the Fall Truman Lecturer speaks. Arguably, this is the most popular event at Grand Lodge. It established the Pickard Society, named after John Pickard, the first president of the original Missouri Masonic Research Council. Members may join the Pickard Society by giving small donations. Those donations do not necessarily need to be monetary. They can also come in the form of book donations or even time and effort given to the library. It established the Denslow Society, named for the iconic Masonic authors Ray and William Denslow. The Denslow Society's $1,000 membership fee helps ensure the future of the library and Lodge of Research programs. These steps have helped the Missouri Lodge of Research to gain back about half the members it lost over the 5 years it published the Lodges of Missouri series. So, in an era when many institutions, not just Masonic, are losing members, the Missouri Lodge of Research is bucking the trend with membership numbers on the rise again. The point is, it can be done, but it takes effort, cooperation, and resources. To be sure, the Missouri Lodge of Research is unique, and the way it turned things around wouldn't apply to most other Masonic bodies. However, the reversal of the decline started when the Lodge of Research figured out a way to give its members what they wanted. That's the key, and that's what all our Masonic organizations need to do. Figure out what the members want and give it to them. Easier said than done. Membership in the Missouri Lodge of Research is $25 a year. An application can be found at https://tinyurl.com/moresearch. The books for 2019 and 2020 are the two-volume set Ray V. Denslow's Masonic Journey, the never-before-published memoirs of a 20th-century Masonic giant. Brother Stephen L. Harrison.
I went to a great lodge meeting last night. We opened on the first, second, and third degrees of Freemasonry. The worshipful master called on the secretary to read the minutes of the last meeting. The secretary read the minutes, including every name of every attendee and the names of each officer filling each station. The secretary then reported he also had minutes from a called meeting held since our last regular stated communication. He read those minutes and, in the same manner, ran through the list of names and all attendees and officers in each position. The members present approved the minutes as read. The worshipful master asked if there were any petitions presented. The secretary announced there was one. He read the petition in full, word for word. The worshipful master appointed an investigating committee. Things really got exciting when there was an alarm at the outer door. The junior deacon answered and announced there were two additional brothers desiring admission. The worshipful master admitted them. An investigating committee reported full and favorable on a candidate. We voted. He was elected. A brother from the building committee reported the air conditioner did not have to be replaced, but could be repaired. It doesn't get any more exciting than that. Time being short, we had to postpone Masonic education. What's worse, we had to table a discussion to plan our upcoming fish fry. The worshipful master then proceeded to close the lodge, peace and harmony prevailing. I'm looking forward to the next meeting. That discussion of the fish fry could get really interesting when we try to decide what to serve the attendees who don't like fish. It was an awesome evening. I just can't figure out why attendance at meetings is so low and why anyone would not want to join this fraternity. For the Whence Came You podcast, This is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
So, you guys know, I don't listen to these until I put them and I'm putting the show together, because I want an honest reaction to Steve's work. The second the piano started playing, I knew what was going on, and I lost it. I'm not going to cut this out. I just want to say it was brilliant, and he's so right. We've got a million lodges out that are doing better, but there are a million other lodges that are doing these exciting things. And thank you so much to Illustrious Brother Steve. But it's hard, right? Because when we listen to things like that, we almost wonder, what in the world did we come to this for? What is this? What? Gosh. And to kind of hear the juxtapose here between the Missouri Lodge of Research and what they were doing and giving lodge members what they want, and hearing this kind of sad tale of your typical meeting was, if not eye-opening for you, I hope you found it funny. But then when we come full circle, maybe that's not so funny. You know, it's serious. And what's interesting is the song that's playing in the background, you know, it's a death theme. And yeah, we pick up on that pretty heavily. Like that's the name of the song that we're going to be playing if we can't get things together in a majority way. We need to change the majority lodge experience so that what Steve described here is the outlier. We don't want that anymore. So many thanks to Brother Steve once more. If you like his style, please check out all of the other episodes, 100 episodes of the Masonic Minute. You guys, these episodes are so phenomenal and so amazing, and Steve tells such a great story. If you like this kind of thing, again, go to our YouTube channel, subscribe there, share them with your friends, create some playlists, put them together, play them for your lodge nights, share them with your family members. There's just some really great and inspiring ones. There's some funny ones. And if you get a chance and you see Brother Steve out there somewhere, if you meet him in a lodge in Missouri or wherever in his travels when he does talks, or maybe you meet him on the golf course, shake his hand, tell him thank you so much for what he does, because there are not a lot of people of that caliber on this planet. And Steve is one of the most top-notch guys you'll ever get the chance to meet, to talk to. He's phenomenal. So his books are on the bookstore. You can click more, click on books, and you'll see links to all of his books that he's released. I don't know that I have the Denslow book up there yet. If it's not, I'll put it up there soon. But again, great stuff. You guys got to check it all out. So the next piece I want to talk about is this idea. It's called Solomon's Shamir. And I first ran across references to it in biblical text, but also I had read this paper in the Illinois Lodge of Research about the Shamir. And, you know, we actually read the paper that I'm going to read today on this episode, way back in episode 184, but when I read it back then, we didn't have a lot of context, and we didn't talk a lot about some of the additional information that's available on Wikipedia, so I'm reading it again here in this episode, along with additional contextual information that comes from Wikipedia and some other sources. I think then I forgot about it for a while, and I want to say Graham Hancock mentions it in one of his books, the book that he did in the 1990s about the Ark. And Wikipedia says, in the Gemara, the Shamir is a worm or a substance that has the power to cut through or disintegrate stone, iron, and diamond. King Solomon is said to have used it in the building of the first temple in Jerusalem in the place of cutting tools. For the building of the temple, which promoted peace, it was inappropriate to use a tool that could also cause war and bloodshed. Referenced throughout the Talmud and the Midrashim, the Shamir was reputed to have existed in the time of Moses as one of the 10 wonders created on the eve of the Sabbath, just before Yahweh finished creation. Moses reputedly used the shamir to engrave the hoshen, or the priestly breastplate, stones that were inserted into the breastplate. King Solomon, aware of the existence of the shamir but unaware of its location, commissioned a search that turned up a grain of shamir the size of a barley corn. Solomon's artisans reputedly used the shamir in the construction of Solomon's temple. The material to be worked, whether stone, wood, or metal, was affected by being shown to the shamir. Following this line of logic, anything that can be shown, something must have eyes to see. Early rabbinical scholars describe the shamir almost as a living being. Other early sources, however, describe it as a green stone. For storage, the shamir was meant to have been always wrapped in wool and stored in a container made of lead. Any other vessel would burst and disintegrate under the shamir's gaze. The shamir was said to have been either lost or had lost its potency, along with the quote-unquote dripping of the honeycomb, by the time of the destruction of the first temple at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C. So that's just some general stuff, but there's additional information on Asmodeus, whether that's gemstones, Quran, and mentioning the jinn. There's even some pop culture references, but I found a paper that was in the Illinois Lodge of Research that I thought I would read. It's volume number 8, number 3, page 17, and it's a closer look at the Great Temple of Solomon and the legend of the shamir. Now, I'm going to read this. I haven't read it before, so what we'll get at the end of this is just any brief commentary that I might have on this, and I'm just reading it. So I've not read it before, so if there sounds like there's some interesting information or wrong information, I'm just going to power through it all, and we'll talk about it at the end. A Closer Look at the Great Temple of Solomon and the Legend of the Shamir by Dr. Stephen R. Greenberg. From the beginning of mankind's history, men have been engaged in temple construction. The Temple of King Solomon, erected in the 10th century BCE in fulfillment of a divine command, did possess a singular form through that edifice, though that edifice was not the first structure of its proportion to appear in the Near East. King Solomon, in attempting to establish his nation in cultural equality with his neighbors, borrowed heavily from them. According to Professor G. Ernest Wright of London, Solomon's temple had a resemblance to the Phoenician structure characteristically observed in that nearby country. In more recent times, at Tanit, in the kingdom of Syria, a building of a like magnificence was unearthed, which appeared quite similar to Solomon's temple. The Syrian structure possessed three chambers consisting of a porch, a grand hall, and a sacred inner chamber. On either side of the doorway leading to the main hall were placed round pillars, the bases of which had survived the ravages of time. From this discovery, a structural relationship to the Solomon's temple in Canaan was established. Additional archaeological evidence has shown much Solomonic influence in several areas of Judea, notably at the stables of Megiddo. Among the ruins of long-forgotten ancient cities are buried the remains of great temples in Egypt, Nineveh, and Babylon. None, however, appear to have surpassed the great temple of King Solomon in either recorded endeavor or magnitude. King Solomon initiated the erection of a temple there 3,000 years ago that was destined to archive immortality. The temple's foundation was firmly implanted on a rugged mountaintop, Mount Moriah, the place where Abraham was instructed to sacrifice his son Isaac. Here also King Solomon would receive the responsibility originally given by God first to Solomon's father, King David, a charge to create an edifice, a great beauty and magnificence. This edifice was to be for all time a place fitting to manifest the divine presence amongst the chosen people, a building dedicated to the worship of the one true and living God of Israel. Obviously, then, the location was selected to impact upon the history of the Hebrew nation. The great wealth flowing into King Solomon's coffers allowed the acquirement of the most skilled and ingenious craftsmen from the neighboring regions of Greece, Phoenicia, and Syria. To their number were added the workmen of Egypt, including 80,000 hewers and a mountain 70,000 bearers of burden. Overseeing these craftsmen was 3,300 masters of the work. The timbers, cedar, and fir employed in the temple building were felled and prepared in the forests of Lebanon under a treaty secured from King Hiram. Additionally, Hiram agreed to furnish the 80,000 workmen, who were hewers in the mountains, and for this commitment, Hiram received King Solomon an annual payment of 20,000 measures of wheat, 20 measures of pure oil, and a consideration of 20 cities. Recent evidence suggests that the biblical proportion concerning prohibition concerning the use of iron implements applied only to the actual construction of the building. Because the temples erected in the Near East during these early centuries by the Phoenicians and the Syrians revealed the use of both iron and copper in their construction, it is now believed that iron-edged tools were utilized in the forests of Lebanon to fell hard wood. The actual construction of the temple in Jerusalem, however, was performed devoid of the sound of axe, hammer, or any tool of iron. This was in conformance to the ancient Hebrew custom related to iron taboo concerning construction of the temple as a repository for the Ark of the Covenant. The scriptural account of these activities is referenced in the book of Kings and Chronicles. To commence the construction of the temple, the site atop Mount Moriah had to be leveled and a foundation set both deep and strong. The foundation and the walls were constructed from great blocks of limestone quarried with effort and skill from the thick stone beds underlying the city of Jerusalem. This fine, porous limestone, soft in natural state, soon hardened upon exposure to air. The stones were hewn, squared, and numbered in the quarries. For prearranged positions of the foundation, the material for the massive walls rose to a height of approximately 150 feet and extended across 36 acres. The general ground plan was made in the form of three squares, referred to as the Temple Court, the King's Court, and the New Court. Additionally, the buildings maintained a massive proportion within its main square that contained its most sacred place. That structure was 165 feet square, with gates at the four points of the compass. The temple building proper occupied the west area of the square, facing toward the east, ready to receive the rays of the rising sun. This structure measured 100 feet by 70 feet. On its front face was a porch in the form of a square tower rising upward three stories to a height of 144 feet. On the first floor was the porch, the entrance to which was through a gate of brass. Further, at the entrance to the porch on either side of the doorway stood pillars of brass, 27 feet high and 6 feet in circumference. The one on the south, the right hand, was called Jachin, denoting establishment. The other, on the north left hand, was called Boaz, denoting strength. It is believed that King Solomon, in erecting these pillars, had reference to the biblical pillars of cloud and fire that went before the Israelites in their journey through the wilderness. In his representation, Solomon viewed these pillars as memorials of God's promise of support for his people of Israel. The pillars were adorned with chapiters, upon which were adorned network, containing two rows of pomegranates. Beyond the pillars and porch was situated the most holy place, a room measuring 24 by 48 feet, an apartment none but the priests were permitted to enter. The last room measured 24 feet square and contained the sacred Ark of the Covenant, with the overlying cherubim and the mercy seat. The original Ark of the Covenant, built by Moses, was manufactured of acacia wood. It was 27 inches in length and 16.2 inches in width. The Holy of Holies was separated from the sanctuary by doors of olive wood covered by fine linen, veils of blue, purple, and scarlet. Only the high priest was permitted to enter here, and then but once a year. The ark contained a copy of the tablets of law received by Moses from God on Mount Sinai, together with the pot of manna and Aaron's rod, the symbols of Israel's deliverance from the cruel bondage of Egyptian slavery. On each side of this holy place were chambers of three stories, each covered by a gable roof set at a right angle in imitation of the form of the tabernacle tent. On the east side of the temple court was located an area called the Great Square of King's Court. In its center was placed the brazen scaffold about 6 feet square from which King Solomon offered prayers at the dedication of the Great Temple. On the separate sides of the area were structures large enough to house the many wives of the king. Another group of structures was designed as a private place for Solomon and his queen. The second floor was designated as the middle chamber, access to which was gained by a flight of winding stone steps. This room was set aside for the use of King Solomon to conduct his private devotions. It was in this chamber that some of the most holy scenes of Hebrew history transpired. In the courtyard surrounding the temple stood the great sacrificial altar of brass, 30 feet square and 15 feet in height. Nearby stood a great basin called the Molten Sea, which was 15 feet in diameter and capable of holding 2,000 gallons of water. The building, when completed, fitted together so expertly that it had more the appearance of one entire stone. Its roof of olive wood was overlaid with gold. The various courts and apartments, it is estimated, could accommodate 300,000 people. As King Solomon's holy plan progressed, his ideas expanded to scale much grander than that of the original tabernacle described in Mosaic law. When completed, after almost a quarter century, a grand collection of magnificent buildings and statuary had spread across 36 acres. No edifice before or since the era of Solomon can compare with this magnificence. The noted British architect James Ferguson relates the temple at Jerusalem, the lower court stands on its magnificent terraces, the inner court raised on a platform in the center, and the temple itself rising out of the group and crowning the whole, must have formed, when combined with the beauty of the situation, one of the most splendid architectural combinations in the ancient world. End quote. King Solomon's temple remained intact for a period of 420 years. However, despite its magnificent and holy purpose, the temple fell victim to years of neglect by the priests charged with its care. The end came in 599 BCE, when a great Chaldean army led by King Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem, overran the country, and destroyed the Holy Temple. As a result of this invasion, the Chaldean invaders seized the treasures of King Solomon and enslaved the Hebrews for transport to Babylon. Though treated well, they desired to return to their homeland. This request was granted by King Cyrus in 520 BCE. The Hebrews, led by Zerubbabel, returned to Palestine to rebuild the Second Temple. After nearly 500 years, Herod's Roman legions destroyed the second endeavor. A third temple was later erected by Herod, which stood for almost a century before being leveled by Titus's Roman army. In this saga of biblical history is the inference that despite the many cycles of disaster spanning three centuries of recorded time, the foundations of Solomon's temple, laid deep and strong of immense proportions by countless hosts of ancient craftsmen, has remained unmoved and unchallenged. Allegorically, so it is with Freemasonry. Its foundation, composed of the greatest principles given by God to man, remains unmoved amid the onslaught of time. The opposition of evil men may injure our institution, our noble craft may be vilified from without, and by unworthy conduct from within. Lodges and temples may perish, but for all time to come, our Masonic foundations are strong and deeply set in righteousness. Standeth sure, having this sealing, the Lord knoweth them that are his. And that's where this paper ends. And I'm a little bit concerned, because nowhere in this paper does it mention the Shamir, except in the title. So, I guess I would then conclude that that was a wonderful piece of text explaining King Solomon's temple and its history, but unfortunately no information on the Shamir. If we return back to Wikipedia, then we can look at the portion that talks about Asmodeus. It says, according to the deuterocanonical Asmodeus legend, the Shamir was given to Solomon as a gift from Asmodeus, the king of demons. As we all know, there's this legend that Solomon's ring is the seal, and this ring is how he can control demons that built the temple around him without the sound of axe or iron and all of this. That there were no workmen employed, that he alone, with the power of these demons, constructed the temple. And what's interesting about this account is this is kind of allegorical, right? Like, if the temple is man and your mind, then you're using a symbol. He's using a symbol to control his demons, right? Another version of the story holds that a captured Asmodeus told Solomon that the Shamir was entrusted to the care of a woodcock. Solomon then sends his trusted aide, Benaiah, on a quest to retrieve it. There's a section on gemstones. It says, the Shamir worm was also used by King Solomon to engrave gemstones. Apparently he used the blood of the Shamir worm to make carved jewels with mystical seals or designs. According to an interview with Dr. George Frederick Coons, an expert in gemstone and jewelry lore, this led to the belief that gemstones so engraved would have magical virtues, and that they often also ended up with their own powers, or guardian angel associated with either the gem or the specifically engraved gemstones. In the Quran, it mentions the Shamir when pointing out the ignorance of the jinn. So these are the more demons, or in some cases, they're like the genies that come out of lamps. And these demons who worked for Solomon concerning the occult or the hidden, and emphasizing that all knowledge rests only with God. A direct quote is, and when we decree death for him, nothing showed his death to them save a creeping creature of the earth which gnawed away his staff. And when he fell, the jinn saw clearly how, if they had known the unseen, they would not have continued in despised toil. That's the Quran, translation by Pickhall, Surah Surah 34, Ayat 14. According to commentators such as Ibn Abbas, when Solomon died, his body remained leaning on his staff for a long time, nearly a year, until a quote-unquote creature of the earth, which was a kind of worm, gnawed through the stick, weakening it, and the body fell to the ground. It was then that the jinn knew that he had died a long time before, and until they were working hard, thinking that they were being supervised by him. So he's dead, but the demons keep thinking he's watching them, so they keep working. And then eventually this worm comes by, it bites through the staff, the body falls, and then now they're wise and they're hip to the fact that Solomon's dead and he can't control them anymore. It also became clear to the human who divined and engaged in occult activities or spirit consulting, quote-unquote, or worshipped the jinn, that they do not possess knowledge of the occult. And it just has a reference here in pop culture, Leonard Tushnet's story, The Worm Shamir, quote-unquote, published in the December 1968 issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction, retells the legend in a modern, quasi-scientific term. So now I'm going to have to go out there and pick that up and find it, and maybe we'll do a review on that. If you've got a copy of that or know where to get it, go ahead and shoot me a link over to my email, wcypodcast@gmail.com. That's all I've got for you this week. I hope you guys enjoyed this packed episode. And again, sometimes we catch a cool title like this and it pulls us in and we read the whole thing. And, you know, I was having moments of panic as I'm going through this. I'm like, oh, only two paragraphs left. There's nothing been mentioned yet. And it was a bummer. So maybe it just came down to the good Dr. Greenberg just didn't get time to add maybe another half of the paper. Maybe just simply overlooked it when he was so excited about outlining much of the facts that he outlined, I guess, are kind of already in the ritual. It's kind of word for word, so I digress. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thank you to everybody who helped support this show. Thanks to our brother Shane Newell of the brand new board game, or card game rather, Franklin's Fortunes. You've heard me talk about it in the last couple episodes. I can get my 12-year-old off of Fortnite to play a card game with me that teaches him virtues. If that sounds interesting to you, head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on more, click on Franklin's Fortunes, read a little bit about it, and then click on how to buy and use the promo code WCY. You'll get $5 off your order. You're helping out brother Shane Newell, who created this game. You're helping out this program, and you're getting something fun and educational that you can do with your family. I really can't say enough good about it, so check it all out. That's it. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.